So let's see if I've got this straight. From the beautiful town of Listowel, Ontario, to nearby Elmira and a stint with the Sugar Kings, onto the Kitchener Rangers of the OHL, and now in the mountains of Utah, with just a few stops in between, Larry Hurus, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, there's been a few stops along the way for sure. I mean, I've had a very interesting life, Mike, and I wouldn't switch it for anything. I mean, are there some things I do differently? Maybe. But I think overall, I think that it worked out pretty well. I think there's not that many people can spend their whole life in hockey and retire out of that. And I was very fortunate. I mean, I grew up in a great community. A lot of support. Like I played my minor hockey. I started my minor hockey actually in Milverton, Ontario, and then we moved down just outside of Waterloo, and then that's when I got started with the Elmira Minor Hockey Association. So they really got things going for me. And I mean, I don't have a lot of claims to fame, Mike, I said, but one of the ones I do have is I was an original member of the 1971 Elmira Sugar Kings. So that's what I hang my hat on. So it was really my timing was really fortunate because I grew up with some really good hockey players, and we just seemed to keep moving along, and we'd win, and then it got to a point where had they not started that Elmira Sugar Kings team, I would have been a Waterloo Siskin. So heaven forbid, you know. But anyways, it worked. I think we had nine guys off of our midget team went and played Junior B the next year, and out of those nine, I think four of us got drafted to the OHL. So it was just had a really great opportunity to grow up with a great bunch of guys.
Well, that Sugar Kings team, as I'm sure you know, is still the stuff of royalty on the Junior B loop here in this part of Ontario. And you go from there to, of all places, the Kitchener Rangers. What was the transition like for you going from Elmira to the big city of Kitchener?
Well, my coach in Elmira that time was Jerry Forler. Jerry Forler, again, an ex coach of the Kitchener Rangers, but Jerry was a very low key, like he was a teacher, you know, like he was a teacher by profession, and that's the way that he coached. So Jerry was all very level-headed. Did he get excited once in a while? Yeah, absolutely, like all coaches do. But he was very supportive and really a great communicator. Now, I went from, you know, having this group of guys and coaches I've been with all my life. I went to the Kitchener Rangers, where I met Mr. Eddie Bush. And that was like 180 degrees from what I was doing. So it took a little bit of adapting. But the years I had in Kitchener was great. I had a good time. It took me a little while to get going, but it ended up I got to play with some really good players there as well, and had a really great time.
Why do you say it took you a while to get going? What was the adjustment? What made it difficult?
Well, I mean, I think it was. It was a kind of a style. Like I had a certain type of game that I played, and they drafted me. I was not a bad player when I was 16 years old, Mike. I was number one draft choice to Kitchener, number four overall, so I had, it was news to me. I mean, I was just playing hockey. You know, that I went that high was kind of a surprise. But I'd always been kind of an offensive-minded defenseman, like rushing the puck and all that. And when I got to Kitchener, I mean, Eddie, he was hell-bent on knocking that out of me right away. So changed my style. I remember one time he was talking, would be putting it lightly. Let's say he was encouraging very, very voraciously. Let's put it that way. He said, "Keep your ass back on the blue line. The day we have to count on you to score goals, we're really in trouble." So that was pretty much it. So I went from being kind of offensive rushing type of defenseman to a staying home type of physical defensive kind of guy. And I think too, just adapting, where I had been with the same guys and for so many years, and now you come into a team where didn't know anybody, and just trying to learn, like as a 17-year-old, just trying to fit in, and really it took me a while to get comfortable there. So I think the last couple First year was challenging for sure. And after that, we got rolling. Like this year two, the 73-74 Rangers was still it was one of those teams that, wish we would like to go back and into a time machine and replay those playoffs, the end of that season, because we had such a great team, so many great players on that team, and we did have a good team. But just things didn't stack up for us, and we had everything prepared to head the Memorial Cup that year, but just we ran into Roger Neilson and his Peterborough Petes and kind of put a cold shower on the party there. After that, and then it was just kind of like feeling our way. And I think the big change for me was halfway through my third season there, they made the decision to change the coaches, and Eddie left, and in came Jim Morrison. And Jim Morrison, that went back to the Jerry Forward type of coach. Jim was a great coach. I love Jim. He was very level-headed, very calm, explained things really well. And Jim was a defenseman, so he really helped me out. Like, he would take you off to the side and explain things to you, and that really, I think, saved my pro career. Like, that last half of the season, I think my stock went up a lot, and I played much better like after that. Don't get me wrong, I'm not blaming Eddie for the way that I played. It was the way that kind of it took me a while just to kind of adapt to his ways, but it's difficult when you come off the ice when somebody's screaming in your ear every time. It takes a bit of adjusting to,
Eddie's track record in Kitchener is the stuff of legend. We still tell the story of the time he was so upset with the team that the bus stopped several blocks away from the arena on a road trip home. Okay, guys, you're getting off here. And by the way, you're taking your bag with you and you're going to hump it the rest of the way back to the rink.
Well, that was kind of commonplace for him. Like, he was a big believer. Like, we'd roll up into Sudbury or Peterborough or whatever. He'd stop the bus 2 blocks before the rink and get out and make us walk just so we would be awake by the time we got there, right? So, of course, we had to dress up with suits and ties and dress shoes and everything else. So we're trushing through all this slush with our dress clothes on and then showing up at the rink. But I'll tell you one of my favorite stories about Eddie. Eddie was an entertainer. He was a performer of sorts, but he should have been I don't know, doing vaudeville or something. But anyway, one day, that I think it was the year two. Year two, we had the big team, and Kitchener Hockey Sticks had just started up. So of course, we have to play with Kitchener Hockey Sticks. So anyways, we get going, and one day, Paul Evans, our captain, he'd missed the net twice in a row, and Eddie was just tore a strip off. And he said, but Evans looks at him and says, "Well, how are we supposed to be able to play hockey with crappy sticks like this?" Eddie just looks at him, "Wah!" Anyways, he goes into the dressing room. He comes back out with a broom, like a corn broom. He goes one-on-one on Don Edwards, NHL All-Star goaltender. One-on-one on Don Edwards from center ice, and he tucks about 6 inches off the ice just inside the post with a broom. Anyways, nobody said anything anymore about hockey sticks after that. He made his point. Of course, we gave it to Edwards. We gave it to Edwards the rest of the season. I said, "How can you let somebody score on it with a corn broom?" Anyway, but Eddie was a guy that he had a lot of passion for his game, and I think away from the rink, Eddie was kind of a fun guy to be around. But it just he was just a rough and tumble and hard-nosed kind of guy. I'll tell you another story about Eddie. So I got to be quite good friends with Dave Chambers. So Dave Chambers coached around. He had a legendary coaching career, and we got to talking one day, and it turns out that Eddie had coached him in Guelph, the old Biltmores back in the day. So in year two of Dave's career, like, Dave, I mean, he was riding on everybody, but anyways, his roommate, Dave's roommate, he couldn't take it anymore. He had a nervous breakdown, and he left the team and went home. And Dave told me, he told me that to this day, he still makes the trek to Collingwood every year to Eddie's grave to make sure he's still dead. So that's the thing. So let's just say he had kind of an abrasive personality.
That's incredible. You mentioned Don Edwards. One of those great players you would have played was Dwight Foster, crossed paths with you, Dave Maloney, and a guy by the name of, I don't know if you know this, Larry, but Joe Fortunato. If you go to the Kitchener Memorial Auditorium today, you'll still see Fortune's name on a beam in the
Oh,
concourse.
Mike, you're a beauty. You are. I felt that. So, for our listeners, there's a bit of a story behind that. So, Fortunato, again, he was a real character. He was a very popular player in Kitchener. He never really panned out for him in the pros, but he was a very good junior player and very popular with the people. I think it was the hair. I mean, he had the big flowing hair, anyways, I took my youngest son. He'd never been to an OHL game, so he was spending some time with me in the fall. So the Rangers people were nice enough to set us up with a couple of tickets, and we're walking around just admiring all the history of the Kitchener Rangers. And you can see all the names on the, Stevens, Maloney, Foster. And then I see Fortunato on one of the beams there. I said, Fortunato. I said, what is he doing up there? I said, but I figured his dad sent a couple of his Goombas down there and kind of put a little pressure on the auditorium people to put his name up on the beams. Anyways, Joe was a great teammate, and I had only good things to say about him. He was a fun guy to be around.
We still talk to this day, Larry. And in fact, just recently we had the 82 Memorial Cup team back in Kitchener to celebrate the first championship for the franchise. And the arena at its core hasn't changed. It's been expanded upon a couple of times, but it is still widely regarded as that cathedral for junior hockey. As a young player, what's especially nothing against Elmira, but they didn't have the nice rec center that they've got now, the Dan Snyder Memorial, to play in when you were there. So, what's it like for a kid coming into that kind of arena to play your junior hockey?
It was a great experience, man. You have to understand that, being a local guy, I was in that auditorium quite a few times before I actually started to play there. So I remember my dad taking me to the games, and we saw like Larry Robinson and Abby DeMarco and Walter Kachuk and like those guys like playing, right? So when I got the opportunity, and as a minor hockey, we got to play in there once in a while. Not so often when you're playing in a place like Elmira, you don't get invited to the big cities to all that much. But I had been in there and played a little bit before, so it wasn't totally, new to me going in there. It's of course different when you're going in there and you're the one playing. You're the one now going to be playing for the Kitchener Rangers. So this was a pretty big deal. I think it was a really big deal for my mom and dad. Like being local and growing up, and my dad going and watching all those great players for the Rangers, and then finding his son playing there as well. So it was definitely a big deal for them.
You mentioned Walt Kachuk's name. How did it feel ending up on the New York Rangers roster with the great Walt Kachuk?
Walter was great. I mean, my time in New York, I mean, I was essentially a minor leaguer. I played 5 years in the minor leagues. My time in New York, I was with the New York Rangers for 2 years. I played two games with them in the National Hockey League before I got traded to St. Louis. But I remember my first training camp in New York. We were out in Long Island, and the guys couldn't have been nicer. Walter was such a gentleman. I don't know if he knew that I was an ex-Ranger or what it was, but I was fortunate enough that it was one of the top four draft choices, so I didn't have to go through rookie camp. So I got to go directly to the main camp. So I was right in the main dressing room right away. So I had on my one side, I had John Rattel sitting beside me on one side and Brad Park sitting on the other. And then Walter was right across the way. So I was just kind of like a kid in a candy store. I couldn't believe, like, I kept like thinking, man, I can't believe I'm playing here with these guys. I remember one night we went down to a place. Walter asked me if we'd want to go out for dinner. I said, no, Walter, no, I don't really. Of course, absolutely. So it was Walter Kachuk, and it was Billy Fairburn, Ronnie Greschner. I believe Dave was there. Dave Maloney was part of that group as well. And they took a couple of like the minor leaguers. It was me and Joe Zanuzzi, and they invited us out to this place on Long Island called Al Steiner's. And you walk in there, and you right away behind the bar, they've got all these like silver beer mugs with all the Rangers and all their names engraved on it. So of course I had to take one without a name on it, but it was like we had four people waiting on our table the whole night. It was magical. I thought, yep, this is what it's like to be a New York Ranger. So I kudos to Walter. I don't know if Walter would but Walter was great. He was a great player and a great gentleman.
You were actually drafted by both the New York Rangers and the Indianapolis Pacers in the or Racers, pardon me, in the WHA. How did that work at the time?
Well, it wasn't a whole lot. It wasn't a very difficult decision. The Rangers, like they offered me a contract. It was a three-way contract, if you can believe it. But they offered me a contract where the Racers just basically said, "Well, if you'd like to come to camp, come along, but bring your own sticks and all your old equipment." So they didn't make me an offer. I guess they figured the Rangers were making an offer. They didn't want to get into competition. So it wasn't really a big consideration going to Indianapolis.
You mentioned kind of bouncing around in the minors for a few years. A couple of those stops, you run into another coach who's well known in the game, and that is John Muckler. What was it like playing for John?
John was great. When I ended up going to Providence, at that time it was the Providence Reds. And John, that was the American League affiliate for the Rangers. And I thought John was great. But, there were so many guys within the team that thought that John was such a hard ass. They just thought he was the toughest guy and the meanest guy. And I just spent 2.5 years with Eddie Bush. And I said, Buckler, are you kidding me? This guy's a pussycat. You should have seen what I had a junior to put up with. John was great. John was also a very good teacher of the game. Like, he taught me a lot. Like, John was he was a pretty much a minor leaguer and a defenseman. So it worked out really well for me to end up playing for John, because I had a really great first season in Providence. And I think John, when he played a big part of that. I mean, he gave me confidence. He played me a lot. He always would take me off the side and explain to me things that he wanted to have done. And yeah, he was a tough guy. He was a disciplinarian. And if you showed up every day on time and worked hard and did everything you could, he had very few problems with people like that. But we had one player on our team, Jerry Teeple, who was kind of a legendary player from Peterborough. And Jerry, let's just say Jerry was the best friend of a lot of the bartenders in town. So Muckler, the way when we walked into the rink, when we walked into the dressing room, John's office was off the left, and he had a great big window right in the front of it, and he could see down the hallway, but he could only see like two spots, like down in the dressing room. So he made sure that Teeple was in one of those seats so that he could see Teep every day. So Teep would walk in the morning, he'd have his sunglasses on, like it'd be snowing outside, but Teep would have his sunglasses on. He'd go in there, he'd put all his equipment on. And the last thing he did was take off his sunglasses and put them on and step onto the ice. So it was really a interesting career. Like, I got to play with some real characters. And I often wonder, I said, I think the players today have fun, but I'm not so sure how tight they are, because that, playing in the NHL, even the American League, I'm not sure. But the money's a whole lot different. It's a business. They don't have that much time. You got the traveling and everything else. But I can assure you, like the days we had playing in the American League and the Central League back in the day, we played some pretty good hockey, but we sure had a lot of fun.
You just said something. It's almost as if you were listening to one of our broadcasts this weekend, Larry, because my partner, Paul Fixter, and I talked about that very thing, reflecting back again on that 82 championship team that was just celebrated, the stories we got from these guys, how close they were, the things they did together. And Paul and I said the same thing that you just said. The biggest change has got to be the money. There's so much at stake now. It's like there's hardly any time for fun, and still you're playing a game.
Yeah. Well, now the guys, I mean, they all have their mental coaches, their off-ice coaches, their stick handling coaches, their skate. I mean, they have so many draws on their time, and I know they're only allowed like so many hours a day to be at the rink type of thing, but outside of the rink, they're still expected to, perform and do all these other duties. And I think too, the fact that like now in professional hockey has become a real melting pot, like from players from all over the world. So it would be a real challenge to kind of build that homogenous type of group, that we had back in the day. Because for the most part, I remember the Rangers, like, Rick Chartrand being an American, he was kind of an outsider, So wow, an American for the Kitchener Rangers. But pretty much everybody else within the team were all small town guys, and they got along. Everybody got along really well, and the same thing like going in. In my years playing pro in the US, for the most part, they were almost all Canadians and Americans. So, I mean, it was much easier, I think, to build that type of team chemistry, So today it would be a huge challenge. Like the coaches, it's coaching at any time is challenging, but today's hockey, coaching these guys that are making 5, 10, $12 million a year and trying to build that, trying to hold everybody accountable. And trying to make everybody feel like, your fourth liners, you're trying to make them feel like you're superstars. It would be a very, very difficult challenge.
I know that particularly for a defenseman, we always talk about having to have one's head on a swivel. Playing as a defenseman in that era, Larry, what was it like? How much more aware of your surroundings and your place on the ice did you always have to be?
Well, when Wilf Paymont was on the ice, you had to have your head on a swivel and know where he was, So otherwise, he was going to take it off. But I think the game itself is pretty. It's pretty much the same. It's just a whole lot faster. I mean, today's athletes, they're more skilled. They're quicker, they're stronger, they're better conditioned for sure. I mean, going into Kitchener, like even the 3 years I was in Kitchener, I like when you talk about off ice training and preparation for training camp, I would get a letter. I could show you the letter. I get a letter from the Kitchener Rangers from Eddie saying, well, a series of running and calisthenics will get you in good shape. See you in training camp. And that was pretty much it. You were left on your own. So, but the game, getting back to the game itself, I would love if you could have any clips of us, the 73-74 team, to see some clips of that, to see what it looked like, because as we remember it, I mean, that was a top level junior, hockey in the day. You were, one step below or step and a half below the National Hockey League. And, I mean, I remembered it as really good hockey is moving pretty fast. But when you watch the game, how it's played today, I mean, it's a different type of game in that way. But the game itself, the basics of the game are still pretty much the same.
How much different was it when you made the decision to leave North America and head over to France?
Yeah, it was definitely it was something I had to think about for quite a bit. But basically, it came down to this: is that I wanted to play in the National Hockey League, and after 5 years in the minors, it became quite evident to me that that wasn't going to happen. I just didn't want to play in the minors anymore. And I had a couple of friends of mine that had left the year earlier. One was playing in Switzerland, one was playing in Austria. And at that time, you were writing letters, right? So you were writing letters back and forth. So they said, Larry, this is great. As we know you, I said, I think you would really enjoy it. So that was pretty much what decided it for me. I said, I want to go try something new. So what I did back then, there was no agents or anything like that. There was no internet. But basically what happened is I got all the addresses of all the first division teams all over Europe, Finland, Sweden, France, Denmark, whatever. And I put together a little resume, and I had a couple of letters of recommendation. One of them was from Mr. Emil Francis from the St. Louis Blues, and he wrote a very nice letter for me. And I think that opened some doors for me, because then I got three offers out of that, one in Denmark and two in France. And then the one that I went to in France was Grenoble. And the reason I chose Grenoble, because I'd never been to Europe before, but I knew Grenoble from the 68 Olympics. So I'd at least heard of France and Grenoble. So I just said, okay, here we go. And that was the start of an adventure for sure.
That's amazing to me. Thinking back, you basically had to apply for jobs all on your own, just like the old-fashioned way we would do it if we wanted a job at the local coffee shop or something.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, and then started going back and forth. And on my resume, I have to say, on my resume, I put on my resume that I spoke English, French, and German. And I'm thinking, well, wherever I sign, I got the whole summer to learn the languages, right? So, anyways, I did take some French in high school. And the last year I played in Port Huron, Michigan, was in the International Hockey League. And I was going to St. Clair College. They're taking a German course. So I had a little bit of a language background. But as soon as I got on that plane and they started talking French, I was kind of like lost, So, and but what I was doing though too is with on my team in Port Huron, one of my teammates, Serge Menard, was from Quebec, so he was my translator and he was the guy writing the letters for me. But when I look at those letters afterwards, his French was so bad, it was pretty bad. But they had to believe that it was from me because it was so bad, like this guy from Ontario, is this looks believable. So that was an adventure, like landing. My timing was exceptional. But you can imagine, I ended up, all the horror stories I heard. Like I filled up a great big trunk full of stuff, my essentials. Well, first of all was my albums. I had to have my music. And then I heard the toilet paper in France was terrible. So I put about 24 rolls of toilet paper in there. I took my own toilet paper with me. And anyway, I have to fly into Paris. And at that time, I had to fly into Charles de Gaulle, the big international one, and I had to switch airports to go over Wassy, to get on a bus, to go to Wassy, get on another plane, and then fly into Grenoble. So, and then my French was so limited, but you can imagine like what an adventure that was, like just trying to figure out, where we're going, because there's no English anymore. Everything was in French. So that was the start of an adventure, and I was in Grenoble then for 3 years. And as I said, my timing was excellent. We won the championship our first two seasons there, the first two times that team had ever won. And actually, we just had a reunion. I was invited back to Grenoble in the beginning of December. It was the 60th anniversary of the club. And then through the winter, they were inviting certain teams back. And that particular weekend, beginning of December, they were invited back the two championship teams from 81 and 82. So that was kind of fun. I'd seen guys I hadn't seen for 40 years, you know. So I made sure to take a look at the team picture ahead of time and go through all the names and stuff. But overall, all the guys looked pretty good, and we had a really good time. It was really great to see everybody together. But getting back to your question on that, is that it was just being proactive and just deciding this is what I want to do, this is where I want to go, and then just chasing it down. And then once you get to Europe, you become part of that country club. You know, like when you're in the United States, you're in junior hockey or whatever, like the coaches especially, once you're inside kind of that group, you can generally, if you're successful, you can move around within that kind of group a little bit. And that's what it was like going to France. So when I was in Grenoble for 3 years, and then I decided I wanted to change up, and I had a great offer from a club in the southern part of France called Gap. And we were in Gap for 5 years, loved it. Right in the southern Alps region, beautiful area. My two oldest children were born there, and we had a great time. And then after that, when I decided to get into coaching, we moved up to Rouen, which is just west, 100 kilometers west of Paris, and I became a player coach. And that was really kind of fun too, because I wanted to get into coaching, but I still wanted to play. So at that time in France, there was only two of us, I think, in the league. I mean, it was kind of on the way out, but you still had guys that were playing and coaching at the same time. So my president of Rouen, he figured, hey, for the same amount of money, I'm getting a coach and a defenseman. So it worked out. And what I tell people, I said, being a player coach is great, because if you're on the bench and you get really frustrated about on something, you can jump on the ice and knock the piss out of somebody. So that's the biggest advantage to being a player coach. But and then after that, then I was I think I left. I was 38 when I hung up my skates, and just became a full-time coach, and then moved to Switzerland. And that's a whole other adventure there.
How much Reggie Dunlop was in you as a player coach?
Well, you know, Reggie, I can tell you this: the most difficult thing for me, from going to be a player to a player coach, was that I had to separate myself more from the team. And like anybody that knew me or ever played with me, I was always in the middle of everything. Like, you know, any kind of gag, any kind of party, I like sitting around having beers and talking with the guys, and you know, just being part of the guys, I think. And I found that difficult. Because like the first years didn't change so much, but I just really came to the realization that as time went on, I had to pull myself away from that and become more of a coach and less of a player. And that to me was the most difficult part of the whole thing. I was fortunate to have some good assistant coaches with me that would help run the bench during the game. And generally I would let them run the forwards, I would run the defenseman, and it worked out pretty well. So my time in Rouen, we won four national championships in 6 years. So we did pretty well, and we went to the European Cup finals twice. So it really kind of launched my coaching career, and it was the successes that we had in Rouen that really got me the opportunity to go to Switzerland, and that was a whole other level.
And we'll get to that level in just a second. But I was thinking on the stops you were just talking about, Larry, and how many there were. And we've got a name for guys like that in the game, right? We call them suitcases. How many times have you packed and unpacked and moved the family around?
You know, I was fairly fortunate that way, in that there was not a lot of, you know, start a season with one team, get traded to another, and then get traded to another. You know, when I went to Europe, I was 3 years in Grenoble, 5 years in Gap, 6 years in Rouen. So I had fairly lengthy stays. Now, when you become a professional coach, especially in Switzerland, you know, you have to be able to move relatively, you know, quickly and sometimes often. But I had a fair amount of success, so I was pretty fortunate. I was 2 years in Zurich, and then I was 4 years in Ambri, another 2 years in Zurich, and then 4 years in Lugano. So I had some pretty good stints there, you know. So later on in my career, I was moving around probably a little bit more, but that was more out of choice, where you know, I went to Norway, and I knew I was only going to go to Norway for a year, but I just wanted to try it. I wanted to try something different. I'd been in Switzerland and then in the NLA for 13 or 14 years, and I just felt like I was kind of like that gerbil on the spinning wheel, just kind of running faster and faster, but always in the same place. So I went there. I went to Austria for a year, and then I went back, and then I went back to Bern. I was back in Switzerland for a while, and then the this I think and then I ended up going to Germany for a year, and again it was just the way it worked out. Then I ended up going to Modo in Sweden, and that didn't work out, and that's unfortunate. That's another story. Maybe we talk about that later. But yeah, I think relatively speaking, for as many years as I was in the game, you're going to be moving around. So as many years as I was in the game, I was pretty fortunate to have some pretty good stays in some places.
You know, I'm thinking back on what you said about that 73-74 season in Kitchener when Roger Neilson and the Peterborough Petes got the better of you in the playoffs when you thought you had a team that would be able to compete for a championship and if you could do that one again. And then comparing it to what happened when you went to Europe and all of this success, Larry, could you imagine what would have happened if you had not? Like that seems to be a real milestone in your career.
73-74 Rangers.
Well, no, just like when you went to Europe, like all of the
Yeah.
success that followed you, right? The championships, the European Cups, you name it, it all started. If you hadn't made that decision to go to Europe, who knows? Do you ever think back on that?
Oh, I think back on it. I mean, I think back that 73-74 series. I mean, when you think about things you should have done differently, I remember at the start of that series against Peterborough, Stan Jonathan grabbed Dave Maloney and really, really wailed on him. I mean, really, and Dave wasn't Dave. Dave could fight, but he wasn't a fighter, you know. And nobody stepped in and challenged Stan. And Stan, if you remember Stan was about 5 foot 8 with high heels on, but he was like a fire hydrant. I mean, you could punch Stan 10 times, and if he got one shot in, that's all he needed. And of all the guys that I fought in the OHL, and I fought all the big guys, I fought all the tough guys. Stanley was the one guy I didn't want to mess with because I saw him with Chartrand. He like and Rick Chartrand was a good fighter and a big dude, and Stan just he shocked the crap out of him the one day. And honestly, Chartrand or I should have gone after Jonathan. We should have gone after him right away just to set the tone, and that changed the series. They got on confidence. They got on a roll. Obviously for Dave, it wasn't a great start for the playoffs for him, but that's for sure one thing should have done differently. So Stanley, if you're listening, meet me out behind the place out there. We'll have a go to here.
You still gotta atone for that 50 years later.
I gotta make up for it. Even if I get my nose broken another couple times, that would be okay. But let me just say this about Stan Jonathan. Stan Jonathan, I have the greatest respect for him. I mean, he made a career in the National Hockey League just out of hard work and toughness. I mean, I don't think anybody played the game a pound for pound that was tough, as tougher than Stanley was. And so Stanley, if you are listening, kudos to you, brother.
How hard was it for you, Larry, to play that role? You said you never backed down from any of the big guys on the other teams.
You know, it was not hard for me because fighting is something I always kind of did, always since I was a peewee. You know, and it's something I really enjoyed. It's a part of the game. I enjoyed it. And actually, a lot of people that make the comment that said that Larry was a better player without his gloves on than with his gloves off than with his gloves on. You know, so no, it was always just kind of part of it, and I enjoyed it. It was a part of it, but I didn't want to play the role of a goon, like just to be sent out to go after people. I knew what my role was, and again, that's the one time I should have stuck up for my teammate that particular time. So, but I learned a lesson there, and afterwards, anyways, we had a lot of good fun doing that for sure.
Do you think there's still a place for it in the game today?
I think so. I think there is. I think it's part of hockey, but you know, people think are crazy, like. When I talk about the Kitchener Rangers, like playing OHL Junior, like we'd have at least one fight a week, like in practice, you know, like there'd be, you know, and then, you know, guys would, you know, bump hands or whatever, and it'd be over. But it was just something that was just more of a part of the game. And I think there's a place for it, but I think there's a place for it now. Once we got out of the dark ages of the NHL, I'm talking about the Philadelphia Flyers back in the 70s and that, where that was just pure intimidation. I think now when players are the players, the fighters can generally are decent players. I mean, there's not too many guys in the league that look way out of place because they're great fighters, but they cannot play. So, I mean, I think right now I think of Curtis McDermott. So Curtis, I've known Curtis since he was a little boy. So his dad and I are good friends, like growing up in Sauble Beach area there. And Curtis, arguably, probably the best fighter, if not top three in the National Hockey League right now. But Curtis can play. I mean, he's 6'5", like he's a manster. But you take a look at Curtis, like with his like in a bathing suit in the summertime. Like this guy is chiseled, right? But he's a guy that just worked his butt off, worked on his skating, worked on his game, and he can play. He's not just a fighter; he can play.
You mentioned earlier that you'd had the chance just before Christmas to go back to Grenoble and celebrate with the championship team over there. I believe just earlier this year too, not too long ago, since we're sitting down here, you were over in Switzerland celebrating a bit of a reunion as well.
Yeah, I just got back actually, so I was invited back. We had the retirement ceremony and a sweater hanging for one of my ex-players that I coached in Bern. So we won a championship together in 2010. So they just retired his jersey. So the club was nice enough. Philip wanted to have me there, and the club was nice enough to invite me back. And they paid the whole shot, and I said, sure, I'll come along. It was a great party. Just again to be with all those people when you win a championship, and you can go back to the 82 team. So that was Scott Stevens and that crew, right? So that's those guys have a special bond. So that was Sean Burr. I think Sean Burr was on that team as well. And but anyway, when you talk about those teams, they have a certain bond. Having walked through the fires and come out the other end with a championship, it creates a certain bond. So when you go back and you get a chance to be around the guys again, you automatically get some of that feeling back again. You kind of flashbacks of what great times it was and how wonderful it was to win that championship.
You were talking earlier about being a player coach before becoming just a coach, having those great assistants that helped you make that transition. Did you know that's where you wanted to head to in the game?
It's funny. I never really started out planning on being a lifer in hockey. It just kind of worked out that way. So I know that there's a lot of ex-professional players that have a tough time dealing with that. When they go from their playing career and all of a sudden their playing career comes to an end, it's usually fairly abruptly. And all of a sudden now they have to get into the real world, get a real job, and then just kind of be like everybody else, where they don't have the same support system. They don't have that team. They don't have like all the managers and people like kind of helping them. Now they're on their own. They have to do their own thing. And I remember talking to one of my ex-teammates at one time, and I bumped into him about, oh, 10 years after like we played together, and he'd retired, and he was selling vacuum cleaners in the Kitchener-Waterloo area. And he told me, he says, Larry, he says, you might think this is kind of funny, but I get the greatest kick out of selling when I close a deal and selling them. When these people are so excited about this vacuum cleaner and I close a deal and sell that black, it's like I just won the game. It's, you get that same type of rush, that adrenaline rush after when you're having a great game and you win the game. So there's a lot of players that come out of that have a tough time dealing with that because they miss the camaraderie, they miss that rush, all the adrenaline that's pumping, like during hockey games, playoff games, all that stuff. That's what you miss.
What made Sweden and Modo an attractive proposition for you, and why didn't it work out?
Well, yeah, it's Well, first of all, when you have a guy like Peter Forsberg, Peter Forsberg called me personally to invite me to come to Modo. And this is Peter Forsberg, I met with the GM. The GM, I was coaching in Germany at that time. The GM come down. We hit it off really well. He was there for 2 or 3 days, I think. And anyways, it was always something was on my bucket list. I wanted to do that. I wanted to coach in Sweden because they don't have very many Canadian coaches that have gone there. I think I was the first coach in, I think, 20 years that had been in the SHL, the Swedish Hockey League. And I was the first North American coach ever for Modo. Like, Modo is one of the most traditional teams in Sweden. So they produced Peter Forsberg, the Sedins. It just kind of keep going on. Marcus Naslund. You keep going on about all the great players that have come through that club and the traditions in that club. So it was an honor for me to go back and then jump into to coach that team in Modo. So Why it didn't work out, we could talk for half an hour on that. I mean, I have to take my responsibility to the part of it. When you go into a new league, it's kind of figuring out what works and what doesn't work. So you come in with some ideas, you have to figure out, okay, that doesn't work, I got to change that. And then you kind of get things going. But bottom line is that we started, the biggest mistake we made was we started with two inexperienced 21-year-old goaltenders. And it was just too much pressure for these kids. They're both great kids. They both worked hard, and they just didn't have anybody to give them any kind of direction. So, when your goaltenders are playing in a league like that, when they're around 80, 85, 86% save percentage, it's going to be difficult, And then we just ran into a whole bunch of injuries. It was just unfortunate because we got off to a pretty good start for Moto. They finished like last and second last for 2 years in a row. And after 8 games, we were like 4-4. So we were kind of middle of the pack, and everybody was happy. But then I think we lost 6 in a row or 7 in a row, and all of those we lost, I think 5 out of 6 or 6 out of 7, we lost by 1 goal. And it was just, things just it, and craziness. Like, I mean, we're getting into games where I'm looking to the heavens, thinking, "Are you trying to tell me I shouldn't be here?" Like some of the stuff that happened. But I will tell you this: I loved the people I worked with. Peter Forsberg is a first-class person. And the people within that group, like at the management level, were very, very good. The players were fine. I mean, it was just kind of learning to, work together, but yeah, so when Peter called me, they said, well, they wanted to change the culture within the club. He just didn't tell me I only had 15 games to do it, so. So that was a quick exit. So definitely the biggest disappointment in my career by far, not even close, because I felt like I let a lot of people down, especially other North American coaches. So a lot of people say, oh yeah, like a North American coach, they can't coach in Sweden. It's totally different. And there are some things that are quite a bit different, but still hockey. And I mean, you still have to figure stuff out. And that is for sure one, Mike, I would love to have a redo on that one there. We would make a few changes, do things a bit differently for sure.
It's always been said, Larry, that coaches are hired to be fired, but do you ever get used to it?
No,
Yeah.
it's never fun. And I mean, I was relatively, unscathed until I got to Switzerland. Like all my time in Rouen, I was there for 6 years, and basically I left because I just decided I was going to leave. I just felt I was stagnating there, and I wanted to do something different. So once I get to Zurich, I mean, Zurich was the team. It was a real problem team. Like no coach had finished 2 years there in 25 years. So you're kind of thinking, how this story might end before you step into the situation. But when it actually comes down to it, and it's a crazy story anyways how it did. But anyways, we had 2 good years there. The start was a little bit rocky. I signed a 2-year deal going into Zurich, and then after 12 games, and this was in a 36 game schedule, after 12 games we still hadn't won a game. We had 3 ties, and there's games we should have won, but we didn't. And it was just kind of, just changing the losing mentality and changing the culture. And then we won 13, we won 14, and then we started to roll, and we actually made the playoffs. So that was kind of saved things going. The second year, we actually had a pretty good season. But after at the end of the season, it was time to move on. But what happened then is that I say sometimes, one door closes, the other one opens up. And I ended up going to Ombre. And the 4 years we had in Ombre were 4 of the best years that I've had as a coach. It was still one of the best jobs I ever had. I had some incredible players to coach. We had some really tight teams. We set it well. In year 3, we set a new record for wins and points. This is Ombre that never, this is a village of 400 people. So, and we ended up winning 2 Continental Cups and a Super Cup. We beat Magnitogorsk. We beat the Russian champions in a one game all take all for Super Cup. And we were European champions with a village of 400 people. And it was really an incredible success story, and so proud of everything that we accomplished there. And it was really a special time. And that kind of set the stage. And then I went back to Zurich. So they called me back because I remember when I went back to Zurich the second time, My friends, they said when I told them I was going back to Zurich, they said, "Well, didn't they fire you the first time you were there?" I said, "Yes, but they said they were sorry and they promised they wouldn't do it again." So that year, that first year, we won the championship and we won another European Cup. It had never been accomplished by a Swiss team before. So you're thinking, okay, things are going pretty good. Well, this is Zurich. So the next season starts, bang, injuries. I had Mark Streit on my team. Mark Streit went down in the preseason. I lost three of my top defensemen before the season even started. Anyways, you could kind of see the train coming down the tracks. So I think 2 months into that season, I got fired. So that's just it's the way it is. But you never get used to it, and it's never fun because it's one thing for a coach. I changed. There's one time, like when I was in Bern, we my first year in Bern, finished in first place, won the championship. The second year, we finished in third place. We lost in game seven of the semis in overtime. And so, two pretty good seasons. So, we start season three, and we're in third place, doing okay. And then we lost 3 1-goal games in a row, and I got fired. And the last one was at home in overtime by a knuckleball from the blue line that my goalie could have stopped with his bare hand. But anyway, what happens then the next morning, the manager from Lugano calls me up and he says, "Well, can't understand what's going. How about coming back for Lugano?" I'd already been in Lugano before. We'd been in Lugano and won a championship there. And they said, and I started laughing. I said, "What are you laughing about?" I said, "The next game that Bern plays is Tuesday in Bern against Lugano." So they wanted me, I was going to be coaching Saturday night. I got fired Saturday night. They want me back on the bench Tuesday night in my rink coaching for the other team. So it's sometimes just crazy how things go. But what people don't understand or they don't realize is that, like, there's a whole family and a whole other bunch of people behind that affects that has a great effect on. So when I change jobs, when I go into a new dressing room, I immediately have a support group. I have, the medical corps, all the staff, the office staff, and the players. So you walk in, you're good to go. But for my wife and my children, they've got to move. They got to find new doctors. They have to go to a new school, make new friends. So it's really disruptive for the family for sure. And I think I know marriage it's at best a 50-50 shot for most people. But I think for professional coaches, it's much less than that, just because of all the stresses and strains and moving around and all that stuff. And it takes a special people to be able to support that. But I always felt the support from my wife. We're now married 42 years, and my children. So they like except when we moved from Ombre back to Zurich after 4 years down there, where my daughter was about 13 years old, and I told her we're moving back to Zurich, and I had to move her out of her school and away from her friends. Where I was just like Genghis Khan. I was the worst father ever, but that's the way it is, So they look back now at their lives and think how blessed it was and how fortunate they were to grow up the way that they did. They all speak four languages. They've had incredible experiences. They travel the world. I mean, they're such seasoned travelers. They're all over the place. So, and mostly with their jobs now, with my oldest son and my daughter, they use all their language skills and they still do quite a bit of traveling. My son right now is in Taipei, with his company, and my daughter just got back. She works out of Seattle but flies back and forth out of Salt Lake. So they're all over the place. So very proud of my children. They're very accomplished.
As you should be. That's a true testament to the family unit, Larry. I love to hear that. In listening to your stories about coaching, I hear the word culture come up quite a bit. And I watched this TED talk that you gave that I absolutely loved. So let me bring this back to that 82 Memorial Cup team in Kitchener, since we brought it up a few times. And that team, of course, had Bellows and McInnes and Stevens and Larmour and Eagle. So it won because it had the best players, right? What makes a championship team, Larry?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that it comes down to this. If I was to ask you, if I ask any players, okay, if I give you like five things, say it's talent, you need talent, you need coaching and tactics, you need commitment, you need chemistry. I mean, there's all these things that you need, but players will tell you straight up, it's not about talent. Nobody ever chooses talent. It's like, what's the most important thing to having success? It usually comes down to leadership and commitment and team chemistry. Those three right there. And out of those three, you can't have any of that without your level of commitment. Commitment being number one. And so it's even though you have all those great players, and they had great players on that team, but they were all committed. I can guarantee you right now, having go back, if you talk to them, if you talk to Scott or you talk to Mike, you talk to any of those players right now, you will say they had a tight group and they were committed to the goal. The goal was to win a Memorial Cup. And that's what it really boils down to, you know, because nobody ever chooses. When I talk to people about that, I say, well, how important is my great coaching and my tactics? Not that important, really. And the level of talent, not that important. It comes down to leadership, chemistry, and commitment. Those are the big three, and you cannot with anything or have success at anything without a certain level of commitment.
I love how you said success at anything, because I think that does apply beyond the sporting arena too, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, your kids are a
It
great
doesn't
example.
matter what. If you're in the military, you're running a business, it really doesn't matter. If you don't have people that are committed to the common goal for whatever you're doing, you're not going to be successful. And we talked before about culture. So I've always said that the greatest responsibility for any coach is to create that winning type of atmosphere, to create a culture that these players, they know when they walk into that ice rink or they walk into that dressing room, there's certain expectations and there's certain things that they know that they can count on, okay? And that comes directly from the coach, you know, about how he's going to run that team and the type of atmosphere that he's going to build around his team, you know. So players want to walk into a place where there's a certain amount of, I know if it's security is the word, but a certain amount of consistency, you know, where you walk in and you know, okay, these are the rules. If I break the rule, this is what's going to happen, okay? And that's the same for everybody. So accountability is something that goes along with it. But I can tell you this, Mike, every player I've ever coached, they'll all agree that yes, we need accountability until it's them being held accountable, right? So it's something that, you know, as a coach that you have to hold the line and you have to say, look at this is what our expectations are. And if you come and you're going to play for this team, this is what it's going to be like. So, you know, here we go. And then again, that comes down directly from the coach.
You've described yourself as a hockey lifer a couple of times in this conversation, and I think it's true because we've traced the roots all the way back to, you know, small towns in southern Ontario to where you are today in Midwestern United States, all this time in Europe where you were behind a bench or playing, and now hockey coach vision. What are you selling software?
Yeah, I've become a sleazy software salesman. So you know, it's really funny when in my former life as a coach and player, whenever I would call up anybody in hockey, 95% of the time the people were happy to have my call and would take my call and get right back to me. But now, as Larry the software salesman, you know, people aren't they don't respond quite the same way, you know. But it's been a great adventure too. With this software that we've created, it really is a fantastic tool. I think we have four or five teams in the National Hockey League using us, and then an abundance of junior teams and pro teams and US university teams. It really is something. HockeyCoachVision.com. Check it out, folks. But it is a phenomenal coaching tool. But what it's done for me, it's allowed me to stay in contact with the game. So every day, like I'm thinking hockey, I'm working with coaches from all over the world. I think we're in 37 different countries now. So, like for example, in Australia, we've probably got 7 or 8 coaches in Australia, about 4 or 5 in New Zealand. And it's amazing, you know, where hockey is played. And with our software, you can also it also works for ringette and inline hockey. So, you know, in places like for example, Argentina, Brazil, they're using it down there more for the inline than they would be for ice hockey. It's really fascinating to be able to work with so many coaches from all over the place. So that has been good. But I tell you, I have a lot more respect for salespeople now than before because I tell you, sales are tough. And if your main client are hockey coaches, good luck. Because I tell hockey coaches, and I'm one of them, so I understand it exactly. We are the most superstitious, stuck in our way bunch of people that you're ever going to find. And, you know, the conversation usually goes like this. If I talk to somebody that's 45 or 50, and I'll show them the software, and they say, "Well, that looks really cool, Larry. But you know, for me, I've got my book and my whiteboard, my whistle and my pen, and you know, it's working for me." And I'll say, "You're right. You don't need this, but your players, your players are going to love it, because today's players, they're so information hungry. They want more and more information. They can handle it, you know. So when they see it, essentially, basically what we do is I can create any type of drill or tactic in animated 2D and play it back for my players, or send it to them, an entire practice of animated drills that they see exactly what's going on. They grasp it immediately. So I said, how much time, if you watch any minor league practice, how much time does the coach spend out there standing in front of a whiteboard? Okay, they're talking to the players, and then they mess up the drill, and they got to blow the whistle, bring them back in, and explain it again. So a lot of times the kids, like that 2D drawing on a whiteboard, they just don't get it. Even I don't get it sometimes. I mean, coaches send me drills, I can't figure out what they are. So when you're able to send them a complete practice of 3D animated drills, they see it, they grasp it immediately, because they grew up in that world. EA Sports and NHL 2000 and whatever, you know, they understand that immediately. So with our software, like now with the last team that I coached was the Italian men's national team. That was a couple of years ago. So, and then the last few pro teams that I coached using the software is they all got the practice the night before, and I would show up the next day, and I would post like a PDF of it on the board. We step on the ice and we go. Like, we would do three drills. I would take a water break. I would explain why we're doing the next two drills, and then we do two more. So we made five drills into practice, and I haven't touched a whiteboard, you know. So you can really get your pace of practice going in at a really, really high level. And that's the greatest advantage to it, is it's all about, you know, the learning curve of all these players, and anything that you can do to help them speed up the process is a plus, for sure.
HockeyCoachVision.com. Check it
Yes.
out, folks. You mentioned superstitions. I gotta ask about this because obviously, as a almost lifetime coach before I became sleazy software sales guy, but how many times did you wear the same tie, same socks, eat the same meal when the team was on a winning streak?
Oh, well, I have the one killer tie. It's still up in my closet. Should I get into a championship game, I still have it there. I haven't thrown that one away. So, oh yeah, I mean, you get into, like, I had that, like, kind of a routine as a player, and I had my routine as a coach, and it's just part of the superstition, but it's also mental preparation, where you're mentally gearing up for the game. So it's a step-by-step approach to that. So you could say these are little milestones. So, like, milestones, especially during the day. You know, like before that, not so much. I mean, when I'm coaching, I mean, I have a certain way of preparing the team. But on game days, I wanted to have a certain structure for me personally, you know. So the game day pre-skate or video or whatever, those would change. Sometimes we'd skate, sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes my videos would go too long, most of the time. But once then, okay, get home, I would have a certain meal, I would lay down a certain time, I would get up, I would do a certain thing, I would, you know. So it was all that mental preparation leading up to the game. And I think that most athletes have some type of routine that they go through. So you could call it superstition. I prefer to call it just mental preparation, like just having routine to help you know, get yourself mentally geared up for whatever you're going to be doing.
I've kept you for plenty of time, but I need to ask one more because you made me think of it, Larry, when you talked about calling coaches. A mutual friend of ours told me that when he was a kid, he would write to you for advice on how to play the position better, tips here and there, how to fight better in some cases, how he could do a better job. How important has it been for you throughout your career to pay it forward, to help the others that are kind of coming up behind?
Oh, I'm big on that. And I think that through our software, I mean, if any of our coaches, like, we have maybe 1500 coaches on our software, if any of the coaches, like, they know that I'm an open book. Anytime that they need something, like a face-off play or an exercise or a drill for whatever, you just contact me. I mean, I'm big on sharing. I had so many people help me along the way. I think, you know, one of the guys we mentioned earlier, Roger Nielsen. Roger Nielsen was probably one of the greatest hockey people, okay, of all time, for a lot of different reasons, you know. But Roger was so dedicated to the game, and he was such a great guy, and he was just a fun guy to be around. And I remember, like, I started going to his coaching clinics in Windsor when I was still playing, and I was thinking about getting into coaching. So I started, of all the years that I think I only missed the first two. The very first coaching clinic that Roger had was at his cottage, up in, I think, up in the Kawarthas or Halliburton. And that was by invitation only. And he invited all the NHL guys up there. They said, well, this is pretty good. We should have a coaching clinic. So we started up and it was down in Windsor. And that was kind of one thing I did every year. But Roger, in the first, 15 years or so, he would present on a different topic every year. And I remember other NHL coaches being there and just listening to him and then saying afterwards, I can't believe he's telling us all this stuff. I can't believe he's showing us all the stuff that he does. He's giving it to us. But that was the way that Roger was. He was all into advancing the game. And his thing was, anyways, he said, look, if a coach is doing his job, he's going to watch my team for one or two periods. He's going to have me figured out. He said, if we're going to advance the game, the only way we're going to advance the game is by sharing. We have to share information and then work off of that. And I had great mentors when I was coming through coaching. And I continue and try to be that as well. So I enjoy talking hockey with people, and I'm still with the OHL. I'm one of I work with the advanced two coaching groups. So I've been with them now for almost 8 to 10 years, I think. And I really enjoy going back and coaching coaches, probably more than coaching players. Their attention span is much longer than players. But I enjoy working with young coaches and sharing whatever experience and a little bit of knowledge that I have about the game, and just enjoy being around hockey people and talking hockey.
This has been an education in the game, Larry, and a real treat. Thank you so much for making time to do this.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Mike. And again, congratulations to you and your career with the Rangers. You're following in some pretty big shoes there to fill from the people that went ahead of you. And again, for all the Ranger fans out there and for the OHL fans in general, I mean, I'm very grateful for the start the OHL gave me and the Kitchener Rangers. And I'm very proud to say that, yes, I am a former Kitchener
Look, kids, look where it can get you.
Ranger. Yeah, you could end up like me, being a sleazy software salesman in the mountains of Utah.
Larry, you're a beauty. Thanks a ton for doing this.
Okay, Mike, anytime.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.